and welcome to the third opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I am Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And we are not live today, so we are not taking phone calls, but we have a rousing show today, a really terrific interview, and lots of things going on. And the first thing that I want to address, because
yes,
it was a big deal last week, when we talked about the fact that Israeli scientists in a few weeks will have a vaccine for the coronavirus. And then we had some callers, one of whom, Betty Jo, who even emailed me later saying that the head of the defense ministry or something said that's not true. Well, Betty Jo, as I sent her all these emails this week with some of these articles, this is from Monday, Israeli scientists are on the cusp of developing the first vaccine against the novel coronavirus, according to the science and technology minister, Ofer Akinuanis. If all goes as planned, the vaccine could be ready within a few weeks and available in 90 days to release. Congratulations to Migal, the Galilee Research Institute, on this exciting breakthrough, Akinuanis said, and I'm confident there'll be further rapid progress enabling us to provide a need to the response to the grave global COVID-19 threat. Betty Jo called and said that was fake news, and then we went on to think.
And she accused us of a lot of things.
Yes.
And I, you know, I don't know that she's a regular listener to our show. In fact, I don't think she does, but I could be wrong. I mean, she is one of the regular critics of our show that we get emails from.
Right. Well,
and we appreciate your comments, Betty Jo. But look, Mike and I were reporting the news as we've been reporting for multiple weeks now. You know, every time updates come out of Israel on the work on the vaccine, which has been going on for a while now. As you know, I mean, we'll get to in a moment Patricia Arquette's lovely statement on it.
Here's the deal that really offended me in many ways. She was saying that it's fake news and I should know better. And one of my retorts to her in an email was, I do know better. I have 50 years in journalism. I know what fake news is. I know what fake news isn't. That is not fake news. People can have disagreeing opinions, even if they're in the government, and reporting on that is not fake news. But to say when when the scientific ministry says that they're close to developing a vaccine, Betty Jo, that is not fake news last week. It's not fake news tomorrow. It will never be fake news. So please, excuse me, I get offended when someone tells me about journalism, which I think I have a fair degree of experience.
I think you do too, Mike. A lot of experience on that.
That is not fake news. So it really offended me. I'm sorry.
No, I was offended as well, because I think you and I take great caution to make sure that we're providing accurate information, and we cover a broad sweeping range of information every week. And sometimes we don't get to everything we have. In fact, most of the times we don't get to everything we have. But I thought, you know, talking about last week, we also talked about some of the anti-Semitic comments that were coming out around COVID, the various theories that Israel is behind it. But then our lovely actress, Patricia Arquette, had a wonderful statement this week. You care to share?
Oh, yes.
Because I don't have my printout for some reason. She tweeted a statement, which in essence is like, was condemning Israel because Israel has reported they've been working on this vaccine for over a year now. And she was like, so Israel's known about it for over a year. Right. You know, it was a very, like...
It was just so anti-Semitic. I mean, really, Rosanna Arquette.
Patricia Arquette. It was Rosanna.
I think, is that her sister?
Yeah, it's her sister.
Yeah. Claims in a deleted tweet that Israel knew about the coronavirus and put lives at risk for profit. She said the March 17th tweet read, so Israel has been working on a coronavirus vaccine for a year already. So they knew it. Vaccines take a long time to know if they're safe. And Kushner Oscar is the major investor in a new vaccine that is supposedly coming here. Lives at risk for process. Profit.
For profit.
Okay, here is the deal, folks. Look, and I've learned a lot, and I know Lorene has too. I've done a lot of reading. The coronavirus has been around for a long time. In fact, on the back of a Lysol can, you can see where it says effective in removing any germs for a coronavirus. This is one breed of the coronavirus called COVID-19. So Israel was working on a vaccine to something that was very similar when all of a sudden the COVID-19 popped up, and they thought that they could modify it a bit so it could be used there. It wasn't like this some secret plot.
Right. This was Israel's biological warfare on the world so that it could take control and reap all the monetary benefit, as some people out on the internet would love you to think.
You sent me something about a rapper. I am not familiar with rapper J Electronica.
I actually had never heard of him either and before this article, this piece in the Forbes magazine. Yes.
That's just what are his lyrics? Gee, I love we also have to tell you, we're using surgical gloves just to protect everything around the station, and we're using Lysol and wiping things down, but getting our papers
exactly.
It's sort of goofy. Where did I,
because we have a lot of papers in front of us.
The article is here somewhere.
He worked on the album with Louis Farrakhan.
I think so. Yeah.
It's in the Ford.
Yeah,
and it has some really nasty anti-Semitic stuff.
I was trying to look for the lyrics. Yeah, the respected rapper and producer J Electronica, friend of Louis Farrakhan, released his debut album on Friday, and it's causing a controversy. Here's one of the second verse. And I bet you a Rothschild I get a bang for my dollar. The synagogue of Satan wants me to hang by my collar.
My God.
It's just, and then there's, did you see, I think I sent this to you. A sheriff in Milwaukee says this is a George Soros Jewish plot.
Really?
Yes.
You sent me that? I don't know. I mean, I saw the Forward, and the article in the Forward about the rapper.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, that just goes to our whole point about, you know, again, what he was saying was very consistent with a lot of things, you know, the synagogue of Satan. That's a statement. That's a quote from Louis Farrakhan.
Right.
I mean, this is the stuff he talks about. This is why we have issues with him. Just FYI, people want to know why. And so when leaders of certain movements refuse to condemn him for some of that rhetoric, thus the reason why we raise it, because it's a concern to us, because he is spreading vitriol and hate. And that shouldn't be a part of any progressive movement, quite frankly.
Yeah, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League CEO, Jonathan Greenblatt was talking
about that.
It was in there. In the second graph, it says theories have revolved around the idea that Jews are behind the coronavirus pandemic. He pointed to tweets from former Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark suggesting that George Soros played a role in a coronavirus epidemic. He also added there's been a lot of white supremacist chatter online forums.
Talking about that. Right, and we talked last week about the theories of the cabal of Jews behind everything.
That's right.
You know, we're behind all this, which, you know, is similar to what the Iranian leader was suggesting last week that we read. But, you know, it all harkens back to the allegations of Jews and money, the idea of Jews and legitimacy. It's very similar to a lot of the anti-Semitism we've heard over time, which, by the way, we'll talk about a little bit today. Jeannie Milgram, you know, again, sort of carrying on our theme of the Inquisition, which went on for almost 400 years. It's amazing to me, historically, so few people know about it. But based on this foundation of, you know, just anti-Semitism and trying to remove Jews and Jewish customs from the face of the earth, which is the goal of the Catholic Church. But so much of that, when you think about the fact that in society at that time, there were very few literate people. You had the Jews who were literate because they had to learn. The boys and men had to learn because they were studying Torah.
That's right.
And then you had, you know, the priests, and you had royalty. But other than that, most people in society didn't, which is why they held such prominent positions in society, and they were the merchants and the business people and the financiers, because they were literate. And that it just, you know, because of that, now all of a sudden, it was like, it just echoes back to that, you're controlling the money, you're controlling this, you control everything. It is frightening, and I think we do need to be aware of it. And I think the one thing I'd ask everybody who's listening, if you
see things like Rosanna Arquette, and it wasn't Patricia, it was Rosanna. If you see somebody making a tweet like that, or you see comments on Facebook or on the internet, don't just be silent. You know, I think our request is speak up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, don't tolerate it. Don't turn a blind eye or go, that sounds interesting. Maybe they're right. Yeah. Which, by the way, I think people do. They go,
A lot of time when I see fake news on Facebook or on Twitter, I will look it up, source the material, and say, hey, moron. Well, I won't say hey. Well, yeah, sometimes I do. But
we can say moron.
Moron, you can say moron, okay. Yeah. It's probably not politically correct. Right, but anyhow, I have used that word on the internet. I'll be the first to admit it. I can't help myself. But I will always look the information up and say, this is fake. You are falling for a white supremacist bot or a Russian bot, and this is just not true.
Or a Chinese bot or anything else. So there's so much going on. This one, by the way, we didn't get to this last week. This just so grossed me out in the Daily Mail. In the UK, their paper, the Daily Mail, had reported they had found.
Oh, is this what you're talking about.
A book. Yeah. They had found a Nazi book, and when I think the woman who had found it, she noticed it because there was like a stench on it, and there was multiple things found. Among them was at least caution, you know. So anyway, I'll refer you all to this article. It was so gross, but one of the reasons why they found the book is because there was a stench on it, and the person who was looking at the book realized that there was like human hair on the book cover, and it turned out that the book cover itself is bound. It wasn't bound in leather; it was bound in human skin.
And from the Holocaust.
From the Holocaust, and it had a tattoo and hair on it and other things. I mean, it was just so beyond disgusting, but this just shows you the depths to which humanity can sink and how evil, you know, if you don't stand up to anti-Semitism, just how low humanity can go. I literally wanted to throw up when I read this article. It's so gross, but it did happen. You know, I've read the stories about how they would make lampshades out of human skin and just use the human hair of the victims,
or the gold from the teeth,
rip it out, the gold from the teeth, or even the human hair to stuff blankets and things like. This is of humanity. I had to take a moment. I just had it. If you were interested, it was in the Daily Mail last week. Let me see if I have a date on it. It was March 5th. Is I think the date March 5th in the Daily Mail.
It's a pretty in-depth article, yeah.
Yeah, and it's too nauseating for me.
I had a rough time getting through that.
Yeah,
in the same vein, you sent me something today about Amazon banning Mein Kampf.
Finally.
Well, but no, wait. I'm not sure. No,
I don't know.
You know, censorship is bad, and sometimes
they're just saying they're not going to have it. Trust me, there are plenty of places people can get that book.
Other Nazi literature, but
published.
I mean, I have read excerpts of it in various places. Sometimes you need to study it to find out just how sick this man was. I really have mixed emotions about that.
I don't know.
Censorship, you know.
It's not censorship. I mean, you have one retailer taking a stand saying we're not going to sell it, but, you know, it's been published in countless languages.
Right.
It's, you know, was a bestseller again in Germany, I think. Wasn't it just a couple of years
ago? Just a couple of years ago, that's
and,
right.
And I think this is and that's really frightening. And I think, you know, at some point we need to say this man was a menace to humanity and to the world, and do we really want to spew his ideology? I don't
know. I
support Amazon in making that decision.
No, but I understand. Yeah. My question is we can't ignore it, and sometimes knowledge of the other side is worth.
They're thinking, of course, or what's their mindset? How are they thinking? You know, so you recognize it when you hear similar rhetoric. I agree with all of that. I mean, I don't condemn Amazon here, though. I mean, we're not burning books. We're not banning books. It's more of a just saying we're making a business decision.
I am not condemning them. I just want to say I have mixed emotions. That's, you know, that's.
I hear you. I know.
I'm carrying the First Amendment torch.
Well, look, yeah, we just talked about this in Israel. You know,
this is crazy.
I mean, so one of the things the Knesset, everything. So you had like members getting sworn in. The
three
Knesset,
at a time.
Right. You know, because of the coronavirus, because Israel's literally shut down. The entire new Knesset can only do three at a time. But they're also addressing, you know, the emergency government addressing the coronavirus. And so one of the things that they wanted to do to stop the spread, so they met, I think it was Monday night, and they passed legislation that would set up a committee that would allow for tracking of people who have been diagnosed with the coronavirus, so phone tracking, that you could track their movement via their phone. Of course, first thing Tuesday morning, a petition was filed with the Supreme Court opposing it. So I don't know that we have a ruling yet on the Supreme Court from that. I haven't seen one. But I understand why they'd want to do it, but I completely disagree. I just think that's such an invasion of privacy.
I'm with you on that. We're on the same page on that. But I had heard this morning somebody on one of the news channels saying, you know, maybe that's not a bad idea.
Oh God.
In the United States, you know, so we can keep it. That's a real bad idea.
That is, talk about invasion of right of privacy. I mean, I this is where I, you know, sometimes I hear people who are, you know, claim to be big supporters of rights of privacy, and then they something like this comes, oh yeah, it's a great idea. No, it's not a good idea.
Now, was this voted on by the entire Knesset? I thought it was, because they called it a power grab.
Well, let's see.
I'm not 100% sure.
We had a couple articles. I had read something about the vote. Where was my, hold on, let me see if I can see the information on the vote.
We have papers all over the studio, and then we've got these goofy gloves. And we're
The caretaker government on Monday night amended and unanimously approved a measure allowing security services to deploy advanced digital monitoring tools in an effort to track carriers of the virus, removing many of the safeguards and oversights that officials had said would be in place to address widespread privacy concerns about the initiative. The petition was filed Tuesday morning. So I don't, I'm not sure. It says the caretaker government on Monday night.
Yeah, because everything.
So I don't know. So I don't know if that's a limited government. I don't know.
Yeah, because they're in limbo because nobody's formed a government yet. And it looks, it looked like Benny Gantz was going to be able to form some kind of coalition.
But not so anymore.
That's so.
Like, it's always changing. Well, you know, I thought the one thing that was, you know, a huge positive, I think Benny Gantz actually received the support of the Arab bloc for him to form a government.
Right.
So I think there were, so he actually got the full support of the Arab bloc that the joint list had.
But they didn't have 61 votes.
Right. And so, but he had been tasked to form a government by President Rivlin. However, there are certain members of, because again, remember, it's always a coalition government. So now there are certain members of that coalition, including, I think, members of the Blue and White.
Three members of the Blue and White Party.
Are now saying, nope, Benny, you know, we're not going to support you. We've got issues with how you're putting together this government. So, he may not be able to do it after all.
That's pretty wild. So, speaking of government, so it looks like we are definitely not going to get a Jewish president on Tuesday. Bernie fizzled out in
Florida,
Illinois, Arizona.
Yeah, it looks like Biden won every county in Florida.
So this year will not be, you know, Bloomberg's out, Bernie's fizzled. And we're not going to get a Jewish president this year. And as we had talked, it was not necessarily in Israel's best interest to have Bernie as the president.
No, I mean, look, all you have to do is look at who his
advisory,
surrogates. His surrogates were on the campaign trail. You know, from Linda Sarsour to Representative Ilhan Omar, Representative Tlaib, and others. You know, I think these are people who have been very much against Israel, very open, Linda Sarsour in particular, you know, so I think I think all of us in the community were like, okay.
Yeah.
There are definitely concerns about the anti-Semitic
people
that were very closely associated with him.
As we've talked, had he got the nomination and won, it's ironic that the first Jewish president might not have been the best friend of Israel.
Right. I think as somebody, he's somebody who may, you know, culturally, that Jewish identity, as I understand from his rhetoric, has never really been that significant in his life. I mean, he's, he may be traditionally or culturally in some ways Jewish, but it hasn't been, you know, I think, which was interesting because in his prior campaign, presidential campaign, he really wasn't part of his platform.
Oh, no. He really almost downplayed the fact that he was Jewish.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he tried to play it up a little bit more this time. I don't know. I'll say this. I don't think the issue here and not voting for Bernie was an issue of anti-Semitism.
Oh, no.
I don't think that had anything to do with it.
I agree 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not perceived by people. I mean, he happens to be Jewish, as you say, culturally.
Right.
But he's not perceived, I think, by most.
Which I actually take that away as a positive. I think it's, you know, I was really, you know, the fact that we could have two Jews, Bloomberg and Sanders, on a ticket. And I think to me that was such a positive in this country, despite everything else that we're seeing. So, and you didn't really hear the vitriol of anti-Semitism.
No, you really didn't. And that is refreshing.
That was very refreshing. So I think of anything that, to me, that's a huge positive.
Yeah. No,
so we walk away with that.
I agree. How about the Dead Sea Scrolls?
I knew about this in the past. Like, I've heard not the Dead Sea Scrolls at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, but these were at the U.S. museums, and I've heard about this, that there are a couple museums in the U.S. and around the world outside of Israel where there were forgeries being sold.
Big bucks.
Huge dollars. And they said that there's a Bedouin clan that's suspected of selling them. So the article, the art fraud investigator Colette Lull and her team discovered that all 16 Dead Sea Scroll fragments on display at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., including parts from the Book of Genesis, were forgeries, the National Geographic reported. The investigators issued a 200-page report on it. Very, very interesting. But yeah, these things sold for huge, huge dollars.
Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls in Israel, though, have been authenticated.
All right, the ones found in the Qumran area, and the Qumran, which, lots of theories around it. It was known that there was a group of prophets that's where they sought refuge.
Was that the Essenes?
The who?
Yeah, there was a group of, they were sort of mystical Jews.
I think it was, but they sought refuge in the Qumran area of Israel, and they had found these scrolls. They had been preserved because they literally were in these cavernous sort of mountains, like caves, and sealed the various scrolls. But I've been to the Bible Museum in Israel.
Can you see
that? Oh, my God. To read these things are just fascinating, and the interpretations of them, and
they're in Aramaic.
Oh yeah, they're in Aramaic, and they interpret. And then you can read them in English too, because they do the interpretation. But just seeing them, they have like a massive, huge. I mean, they have an entire building that's just dedicated to it.
You can spend a whole day there.
You can spend a whole day there. I mean, I was just fascinated just reading it and the commentary and just. And, you know, just really the understanding of the Book of the Prophets. Like, we don't talk about the prophets so much, but just they had such, you know, understanding. You could just see that they regularly were talking about the prophets and what the prophets were saying. And it was interesting because you're reading things that they were writing back then and you're seeing it in the world today. It was fascinating. I mean, if you ever get to Israel, go to Jerusalem, go to the museum, check them out. So,
but what got us started on this was that these Bedouins.
They said it's suspected that they're looking at who the suspects are. But, you know, I mean, I'll tell you, these antiquities, I mean, I think Italy had the same issue with, like, books in Italy, like, because they have so many antiquities, like, people can make those good forgeries and, boom, sell them for millions of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, and when were these written?
I mean, these are 2,000 years old.
Yeah, okay.
These are 2,000 years old. I think somebody...
Before the Common Era.
It was before the Common Era and then just slightly after the Common Era. So that whole time frame, before the destruction of the Second Temple and then sometime potentially after the destruction when people were in hiding. Well, and so,
you know, fascinating to me. I think I read somewhere where, like, they thought, like, you know, I think, like, John the Baptist was thought to be one of those prophets.
Wow.
I mean, well, I don't know if there's any truth to that, but I remember reading something about that. Like,
well, if it was...
He was a mystical, because he, like, wore... He ate, you know, crickets and did, like, you know.
You don't regularly eat crickets?
Not regularly. Not regularly. There, I do not make a habit of regularly eating crickets.
But there's this one theory, and I'm not overly well-versed in it, but one theory that, you know, Jesus disappeared for several years and then came back. He disappeared, like, when he was about 13.
Maybe he went there. No,
that, there's a theory that he studied with the Essenes.
Oh, I never heard that before.
Well, yeah. And then when he reappeared, but he took on some of the mystical properties, but they were a mystical Jewish sect.
Interesting.
So, you know.
Very interesting.
So, I don't know. I mean, there are just some people that have that
theory. I'm sure our rabbi would, like,
yeah,
let us know if that wasn't right or not.
Yeah.
Anyway, interesting. This will, at least worth, you know, doing some research and looking up. But yeah. I did want to talk about Syria, you know, before we get off the coronavirus completely. You know, really sad, what's happening in Syria. There was a report that came out that you and I were talking about the Palestinian women. You know, Syria is just between Russia and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard in there bombing people and just taking over. Assad is just, who's been so wicked. You know, there was a report by the Action Group of Palestinians of Syria that's located in London this week, you know, talking mostly about the Palestinian women, because, you know, we hear a lot about other people in Syria that have suffered under the Assad regime and what's happening. But they reported that at least an additional 486 Palestinian women have been pronounced dead since the civil war began in 2011. 110 others had been secretly detained by the Assad regime, and at least 34 had been tortured to death in his prisons. And that, you know, a total of 4,013 Palestinians had been killed by his regime so far. So just
it is
tragic.
Absolutely terrible. What I wonder, though, you don't hear the same criticism of pro-Palestinian people of Syria,
Assad, Iran.
I mean, you don't read the many articles about people who are standing up for the rights of the Palestinians to say, well, what's going on in Syria?
Yeah, and I don't know if anybody's watched the movie The Cave, the documentary I mentioned a couple weeks back about that one woman doctor in that one town that was being sieged by Assad, and you can hear the Russian bomber planes above them.
But I don't remember that.
On International Women's Day, I mentioned the movie The Cave, the Syrian doctor. She was a young woman. She had just finished medical school. She was a pediatrician. She was literally hiding in an underground hospital for 5 years, taking care of people under this one city that was just constantly under besiege. And, you know, you don't hear about this, but this is real. I mean, these people suffer tremendously, the Palestinians in particular, because remember, you got to remember the Shia and the Sunni, and, you know, and it was a Shia Sunni type war in Syria, which is why Syria, Assad, Bashar, and Iran had aligned, and it's just frightening what happened to the people in Syria, in particular the Palestinians. But you're right. I mean, you and I, we talked about this when we went on air. Like, you don't hear people saying, let's boycott, divest, and sanction Syria.
Right.
And I don't know why.
That puzzles me, you know. If you're going to stand up for the rights of the Palestinians, why not talk about Syria?
Exactly. I think that there's just so much going on. And by the way, in Syria right now, because of the country so war-torn, Assad is not reporting, you know, the deaths under the coronavirus or people who've been implicated. But there is fear because the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is, you know, infiltrated throughout the country and, you know, is throughout Syria, and, you know, with Iranians coming in and out, there is fear that those numbers are going to be high and significant, because Iran right now, I think, has the third highest deaths. You see it. I've been reading reports. It's in the high echelons of the military, like these older generals and parliamentarians, people who are in the secret circle of the supreme leader, if you will. You know, these people have it, and you see these high numbers in Iran, and that is alarming, because look, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is all over Syria, which we've talked about, and the fear for these people now
You know, no reporting, no medical care.
I saw a report out of Iran saying they worried that they could have a million deaths. Because of this, because they're so closely aligned with China.
Right.
I mean, that's part of the problem. There's a more than a symbiotic relationship. There's a relationship back and forth, and long before anything was stemmed and put in quarantine in China, they were going back and forth, back and forth. And probably brought back the virus there.
Right. And there was also some concerns. Which one was? I'm trying to find the article. Ayatollah Khomeini. Ayatollah Khomeini made a comment again about the biological attack. And, of course, there was the leader we talked about last week. I don't have the piece in front of me, you know, sort of claiming that this was, you know, Israel. Israel is behind it. But the fact of the matter is the government in Iran is handling it really terribly. I think the people.
Well, that's not a surprise.
Yeah, and I worry for the people of Iran. You know, serious times right now. But a couple other interesting pieces of news.
Let's take a little break. We're gonna do a break, and then we will be right back with a terrific interview. This is the Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
And we are delighted you are here today. As we mentioned previously, we're not live, so we won't be taking phone calls. Everything is on tape today. But we've got a terrific interview. We talked last week about a documentary that's called The Children of the Inquisition.
Right. And so, and that was with director Joe Lovett. And so this week, we talked with Jeannie Milgram. And Jeannie Milgram, and she and Joe know each other. Jeannie Milgram, fascinating lady, has written multiple books. And I would encourage, I went out and bought her book, How I Found My 15 Grandmothers, which is in both Spanish and English. In one book, you get both, you know, but she went through, I mean, you know, as a young girl coming from Cuba in a Catholic family, she always felt like, you know, I'm Jewish, I'm not Catholic. And long story, she'll talk about it all, about how her family had hid everything. So she went through her own personal Orthodox conversion, then spent 10 years looking for her documentation and what she had to go through and what she was able to uncover. And a lot of that's in her books too. So for people who personally wanted start that journey, she really gives them a how-to guide because she literally did it herself for it. Spent 10 years going back 22 generations. Amazing. But you know, what I found was fascinating, and she'll mention this. I mean, there's a lot of little fascinating tidbits, but because her mother had, you know, it was always the matriarch who was responsible for keeping the customs but hiding it. Like, and ultimately, after she went through all this work and all this effort.
Well, her grandmother was the one that really hid it.
Oh, yeah. And after she went through all this work and all this effort, like, after she did everything, they're like, she discovered that they had a box full of family trees and birth certificates and everything going back many generations. And she's, you know, I mean, all you just, you know. So you never know what you're going to find, but Jeannie Milgram. So.
Yes, this is part one of a two-part interview that we did with her.
Well, I grew up I was born in Havana, Cuba, and I came to Miami like so many other millions of Cubans in 1960, a very, let's say, socialite Cuban family. And I was put into Catholic schools from the get-go. My family was Roman Catholic. And my grandparents, all my grandparents, everybody moved to Miami. And in the Catholic school from the get-go, I came at the age of 4. I was about 6 years old when I started doubting everything that I was. I started doubting the family that I was into. And many people ask me, how does that happen to a 6-year-old? Well, it just does, because there was a pull that I was not part of the family. I kept asking and asking, am I adopted? Am I adopted? My parents were just like, no, what do you, you know, what's wrong with you? No, you're not adopted. I mean, they kept even showing me my birth certificate, but there was just something that was off. And it was, and I was rejecting the dogma of the Catholic religion, but I went through the whole grade school thing. I've always been, spiritual. I don't know what the correct word is, but I've always been drawn very close to God, very spiritual. Then I went on to a Catholic girls' high school, and I mean, there was nothing I could do to except question and question and question the, you know, every single, whether it was the Trinity or whether it was Mary or whatever it was. I was just questioning. I think I just absolutely bored everyone, but questioning. Then I went on to a Catholic university, women, and I was like, I couldn't escape it. I was very young. I had just turned 15. And there, when I started learning comparative religions and we hit on Judaism, it was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is what I was searching for. This is exactly it. And I started gravitating a little bit to Jewish people. But if you know, I'm sure anything about Miami, it's all very, you know, the Cubans live here and the Jews live there. And there's like no, you know, really communities don't often mix. So I got married super young, like at 17. I married a Cuban Catholic man. I had two kids. By the time I was 28, and I just couldn't do that anymore. I baptized my kids. I did that whole thing. And I'm like, I'm living this fake life. I cannot do this. And I started studying Judaism on my own and hiding from what I was doing. I was just doing this on my own. Finally, obviously, it's not sustainable. And we separated and I stayed with my kids and I began to really, really search. I started going to a Reconstructionist synagogue and it just wasn't enough. Then I went to a Reform synagogue and that wasn't enough. Then I went to a conservative synagogue and that wasn't enough. And finally, in my neighborhood, there was a small Young Israel, a shtibel. It was very small at the time. And, you know, everything was like so much pomp and circumstance like I had been growing up with, because Catholic school in the 60s is, you know, there's jokes. I survived Catholic school, but so minus the incense, the Orthodox was very familiar to me. And I converted in a very long process of 5.5 years because I did not convert my kids. I somehow, while I was having this existential crisis, I didn't feel it was fair to convert my children, and the rabbis from the Orthodox Beit Din didn't think that I could run a household as a single mom with two kids that weren't Jewish. But I persisted, and finally, I did not convert my children, and, you know, life continued, and then finally I remarried an Ashkenaz man, and everything continued. I really had a lot of problems with my family. I was rejected by everyone that knew me from before, whether they knew me from grade school, middle school, Catholic school. It wasn't like an out-and-out rejection. I just all of a sudden wasn't included. And my family was like, what are you doing? You know, it's like I couldn't eat at mom's house anymore because I keep kosher. So it was this whole, I was alone. And then we'll get back to this later, but one of the reasons that I do the work that I do is just extending that hand, because I spent so many years alone, and then something weird happened. Every time I would go from like the Reconstructionist to the Reform, the Reconstructionist wouldn't talk to me anymore. Then from Reform to Conservative, that's how, you know, that's how split we are as people. And I lost a lot of friends along the way, people that I really thought I had connected with. So it was a very difficult time, and when I speak about this internationally, I generally, you know, do get very emotional, because I tell my story from the soul of how, you know, how my soul was trying to cleave back to the Jewish people, and it was just rejection everywhere. But I continued, and then my grandmother dies, my maternal. And she had taught me so many things that were Jewish customs disguised as Spanish customs in the kitchen. I used to be at her knee learning how to cook. She taught me how to check for blood in the egg. She taught me how to check the vegetables for insects. She taught me how to take flour and burn it when we were making a large pieces of dough or cookies, as without a blessing, because that's something that, you know, religious women do when they, it's part of our dietary laws. But she never taught me the blessing. She just taught me to put the dough in aluminum foil and burn it in the back of the oven.
Mm-hmm.
So there was just so many things she taught me. Then on the day she died on a Friday morning, and my mom said, we have to bury her immediately. I'm like, Mom, please, you know, you're Catholic, you're Cuban, do it Monday. I observe Shabbat. But she said, in our family, we bury within hours. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. So obviously another Jewish custom. And then on the day she died, my mom gave me a little box with a Hamsa and Star of David earrings. And I realized that my grandmother knew all along she was Jewish and didn't want to come out and say it. The ties of the secrecy of generations, I never knew or thought that we came from the Spaniards, even though she was born in Spain and was my grandfather's first cousin. It didn't occur to me, and I look back and kick myself. How could it not have occurred to me? I was already a practicing Jew. How did it not occur to me that my grandmother could have descended from the Inquisition? It just did not occur to me. So on that day that she died, I started researching, and I went back via the Catholic Church. It took me about 10 years until I got to my 15th grandmother when I wrote my book, my first book, My 15 Grandmothers. And I had amassed every birth, death, marriage certificate proving an unbroken maternal lineage going back to 1545, and a lot of circumstantial evidence. And I took all that. I went to Israel. I had started being very active on social media, helping people who didn't know where to turn, who didn't know where to go. I started helping them. And even though for me, I was already a part of the Jewish people, super proud, and just, you know, president of sisterhood and on the board and all this, I still felt I had a responsibility to all those people that were trying to come back via their genealogy. So right. I wanted to prove that I could do it. It wasn't about me. It was I wanted to prove that it could be done. So I took it all to Israel, and the rabbis were super, super nice, you know, except they told me that the village of my grandparents did not have a Jewish history, and I needed to find it, and I needed to find a Jewish woman or a Jewish man that was connected to my 15th grandmother. Because okay. circumstantial went out the window. I was so disappointed. I think it had taken me 8 years to get to that point, and I had been at it and at it. I mean, every single document. So bottom line, I came back. I went to Spain, and through a very long process, I was able to locate a Jewish presence. I found a couple of mikvahs. I found markings on the walls. Many of those are on my website, jeannymilgram.com. And eventually I found 45 relatives directly on my maternal lineage that had been burned at the stake in the Inquisition Portugal.
Wow. Let me just stop there for a moment, because, you know, we've had Joe Lovett on, who the director who did the movie, The Children of the Inquisition. And I think a lot of people are very unaware the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisition that persisted for several hundred years, beginning in the late 1300s, you know, all the way even through following people into the 1800s here in the New World.
1834, 1868 in some countries, yes.
Right. And so you think for 300, 500 years, these crypto-Jews, like your family, were on the run trying to hide their Jewish identity, you know, trying to be outwardly Catholic, but, you know, to save their lives, you know, but because the result, the heresy, the result of it would be, you know, burning at the stake and horrific torture. So,
right. And I started reading those Inquisition documents because I wanted to know. I wasn't running away from this black history. It's very dark. It's very black. And I wasn't running away from it. But night after night, I was reading, you know, they were caught for wearing a white shirt on Shabbat. They were caught for not accepting money on the Sabbath. They were, you know, they had taken on typical Jewish jobs, like they were furriers, they were shoemakers, you know, back in the day, you know, this is medieval, they were butchers. So they were doing these typical Jewish jobs, and then they were being caught for not selling their stuff, or one was caught for not eating beans, I think it was, on a Jewish holiday or on a Catholic holiday, but like the most inane reasons, and they were burned and they were killed, or all their stuff was taken away. So I located 45 of them. Wow. And then I took all my evidence back to Israel. By now 10 years had passed, and they took 2 years to put it all into Hebrew. And then I got a beautiful letter from the Beit Din, the largest Beit Din Gadol in Jerusalem, stating that I had been born Jewish, that any descendants or ascendants in my maternal lineage would be Jewish, and that God had brought me to this place in a very strange, weird, runaround way, but that as of the decree that they wrote, no one could ever question that I was a born Jew. Now, what that did for me was it didn't change my person, actually. However, it was a milestone for anyone coming behind me. And I also contacted Rabbi Mark Angel in New York, who, because in Israel it's the Ashkenaz, and I wanted to cover all the bases because I have a big mouth and I can express myself and I can travel and I can do, and other people were not blessed this way. So I was just trying to be everybody's like mouth. So Rabbi Angel told me that I needed to go to a special inquisition specialist in Albuquerque, which I did. Dr. Stanley Hordes, and he certified that I had been, the genealogy was correct, and I got a letter from Rabbi Mark Angel stating that I was born Jewish as well. So with this, I knew I was able to help hordes of people.
And we'll talk about how she helped hordes of people next week. That's a fascinating interview.
It really was, but I thought was most interesting, you know, the fact that the actual documents, and we saw this even in that documentary, the movie, The Children of the Inquisition, we saw that, you know, in Spain, they literally still have the written documents of eyewitnesses writing down the trials and the testimony.
Well, as you said, there was an incentive for people to turn in Jews who had converted.
Right.
Because if they were found to be Jewish or practicing Judaism, then the person that turned them in would get their property, right?
Right, right. They'd be accused of being heretics, and but the fact that like Spain, literally in their archives, you can just go and pull up, you know, notes from your relative's trial in the 1300s that still exists today is fascinating. And I was reading the book. There's just so much more to it about people constantly changing their last names to hide as they're moving around to, you know, hide from the Catholic Church and the different authorities, and very interesting. But we'll have part two with her
next. Yeah, but remember I told you a couple of weeks ago I was in Philadelphia at that Jewish museum, and I saw a lot of Lopez's and Gomez's.
Absolutely.
I mean, traditional
what you consider Jewish, traditional,
I mean,
Spanish
name,
or Portuguese names, but many of them are Jewish.
Are Jewish, and they came over to the United States. These were like in the 1600s and 1700s, and you saw the family tree and all that stuff.
Absolutely.
But they left Spain and came here. I thought that I was just pretty fascinated.
Right. It's so fascinating because it went on from the 1300s up until even the 1800s. As Spain continued to expand throughout the New World, and we saw in the movie The Children of Inquisition, people going up through Mexico into what's now the United States, and those areas just kept going farther north, farther north, farther north. So just really fascinating. So I hope you all enjoyed that.
My favorite thing, she says, I've got a big mouth. Yeah. Lorene asked her one question, and she went 13 minutes. Maybe you got two.
I know.
You sometimes you do interviews with people, and you've got to sort of pull it out of them and all that. And
not here.
Not here. One question, man, she was off to the races. Oh, let, let's mention one other thing. This is not really news for Jews, but we can sort of get it in that way. Tom Brady going to the Glazers are Jewish and they own the Buccaneers.
Yes, well that's a great idea. Yeah, because we're like we are so excited that Brady will be coming to the Bucs.
Now I want to say this because it scares me because we are taping this on Wednesday. He is supposed to ink the contract later on this afternoon. So he's playing back on Sunday. I don't want to jinx it because the Bucs have been left at the altar many times before. There was a great article in the Tampa Bay Times today about that, but I recall because I'm a big Buck fan, but I mean, from Bill Parcells that was going to come here, from Brett Favre that was going to come here.
All right, you know what? Stop. Enough. Don't jinx us. We're good. He's okay. Coming. He's coming. Tom Brady. So we're all excited about that. And some other local news. I mean, I know I'm sad about it, but I understand why we did it because we do a lot of senior programming. So the Brian Glazer family, JCC on Howard, decided to close along with over 70 plus JCCs around the country. You know, in addition to the fitness center and the art center, you know, the local Jewish community center does a lot of programming and classes for seniors. They also have special programming for individuals with Parkinson's. I believe they're making efforts. However, if you're listening, they are making efforts to do some interactive stuff online, some interactive courses online. So definitely check out their website for that and see what's available, because I know it's such a lifeline for many people, and I know they're making efforts to ensure that that continues to go forward. So.
But in all precautions. Do you know about the Jewish Film Festival? Because AMC...
I'm sorry. That's the other thing. So I know I got a note from Sarah Scher. They decided to postpone the Jewish Film Festival, but you can check out their website. I think she's got some stuff on their website that you can watch now, maybe some stuff to check out, but it is being postponed. I don't recall seeing a new date for it here. Hold on, while you're here.
Okay, yeah.
I can check and see if I have the email really
quickly. Yeah, because that is a terrific film festival. But
I love the Tampa Jewish Film Festival. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Let's see. Really quickly.
And, you know, the other thing they're saying is think about having smaller seders this year as well.
Right. It was scheduled to open March 29th and run through April 5th. It's going to be just postponed until further notice. So they are planning on rescheduling. So we'll just have to wait till we have a new date for certain. Let's see. They said if you've already purchased your tickets online, they will be honored at the festival whenever it reconvenes. They do have a festival newsletter, and if you need to email anyone about it, if you had questions, you can email Brandy Gold. It's brandy.gold@jewishtampa.com.
What's the website for the festival? Just Google Jewish Film Festival Tampa.
Yeah, but I think if you go to the jewishtampa.com, there'll be a link there for the film festival. So jewishtampa.com.
Yeah, I know Sarah does a lot of work
on
putting that all together. So
yeah, every year. So she's great in the community.
But
so,
I think, it's the right thing. It's the right thing in closing the JCC. What about services? I saw a thing from Rabbi Simon at Charizetic. They were doing services last week. You know, they stream the services every week, and I think some of the other synagogues do as well. But I imagine at one point they're probably going to...
I know my Chabad rabbi postponed services. They weren't having in-person services because I think it all depends upon facilities. You know, are they close quarters? Do you have room? Can you space out? I think there's a lot of questions going on.
I spent several years spaced out. I was ahead of the curve. But
right. and I think, you know, the newest request to limit gatherings, you know, to 10. So, I mean, if you have multiple rooms where you can have people, or if it's a huge space and you have you can divide it up, I think then, you know, that's fine. But you do see around the country people utilizing streaming services online for services and doing different things. So,
and I've heard of some weddings that have been called off and parties.
And absolutely.
I mean, in some ways, it's almost like 9/11, but on a slow drip.
Yeah, you know, I try to, you know, I'm always looking for the silver lining and stuff. Right. So for me, I was like, you know what, maybe it's a momentary pause. It's kind of like a Shabbat for the world. You know, maybe the earth just needs a Shabbat from, you know, just a brief Shabbat for a couple of weeks. And And we can get control. If people can calm down, we can control this thing. So, out of time?
Yes, stay safe. Wow. Stay away from everybody. And we will see you next week, same time, same station. This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5.
Lorene Jaffe.
Mike Deason. Have a good day.